Welcome to Sentient Developments Radio, transhumanist perspectives on science, philosophy, ethics, and the future of intelligent life. My name is George Dvorsky, and this is the audio cast of my blog, Sentient Developments. Topics discussed in this program include transhumanism and issues of human enhancement, technology, futurism, astronomy, SETI and the search for extraterrestrial life, catastrophic risks, existentialism and spirituality, among many other things. So sit back and open your mind to Sentient Developments Radio. Welcome once again to Sentient Developments Radio. My name is George Dvorsky, podcasting to you on Tuesday, February the 21st, 2006. Today's edition of Sentient Developments will be an entire edition devoted to the issue of freedom of speech and freedom of expression, issues of the free press, and the rights that we have to express ourselves regardless of just how controversial or outrageous or completely nonsensical the things that we want to say happen to be or how offensive they happen to be. And obviously this is extremely topical today. Considering, of course, the inflammatory cartoons that were published in Europe a couple of months ago now, and how that's just created a powder keg for many Muslims. And more recently, in fact, yesterday, the Austrian court sentencing revisionist historian and Holocaust denier by the name of David Irving to three years in prison. And I'm going to be talking about those particular issues and, of course, keeping a futurist bent on the topic, or rather on the show. I'm going to talk about cyber warfare and the supposed blogger threat. But first, I'm going to talk about David Irving, who was yesterday sentenced to 3 years in prison for stating that the Holocaust never happened. Now, in my mind, the measure of a free society is just how much bullshit it's willing to put up with before it figures that the bullshit is actually doing some tangible harm. And when I say harm, I'm not just talking about feelings being hurt. I'm talking about something that can be measured as being detrimental to both society and individuals. But in regards to a free society and its tolerance of the so-called bullshit factor, even a free society will actively manage the proliferation of potentially harmful memes by reprimanding those who perpetuate them. The trick, of course, is in figuring out which memes are actually causing tangible harm, to whom, how, and to what degree. And then, of course, a proportionality check needs to be done to determine the harm that's being done in turn by imposing censorship, limiting freedoms, and incarcerating individuals. I can only assume that the Austrian court that jailed Holocaust-denying historian David Irving, that they concluded that the perpetuation of the Holocaust-denying meme would result in it getting out of hand, which would in turn lead to increased hate and violence against Jews. Of course, such a conclusion would be extremely hypothetical and even presumptuous, making their decision all the more problematic. I guess in an offhand way, they're essentially arguing that memes will trump rational thought, empiricism, and due process. I guess they don't want to give the ignorant and those who are easily swayed the benefit of the doubt. In other words, they don't really want to give the benefit of the doubt to those right-wing extremists who are prone to these types of memes. Now, if, on the other hand, they jailed Irving because Holocaust denial is a hate crime unto itself, then one could argue that they're seriously violating free speech provisions and they have come to the wrong verdict. Look, you can't put a guy in jail for being a revisionist historian, no matter how pathetic he may be as an historian or as a person. As it happens, Holocaust deniers tend to be right-wing wackos, but being the former doesn't necessarily or absolutely imply the latter. Consequently, one cannot be committed of a hate crime by this kind of mimetic linkage. It's conceivable, for example, that a Holocaust denier could be, in fact, a very nice guy and a friend to all the Jews, but at the same time, a seriously misguided and hapless historian. Taking this even further, revisionist historians cannot be jailed simply due to the fact that they posit alternative interpretations to historical events. Historiographers know this all too well. The study of historical interpretation, which is known as historiography, is an established, credible, and absolutely necessary aspect of historical study. Historians study previous historians. This is important, so that interpretive renormalizations that have taken place over time can be identified, as well as problems of biases, insufficient data, sampling errors, and lack of linear perspective. Monotone history is unacceptable for the same reasons as censorship is. Moreover, the designation of the Holocaust as a taboo subject for reinterpretation is grossly arbitrary. In addition to the Holocaust, well, why don't we also condemn those who would promote Stalin's Great Terror? I mean, there is enough Stalinist apologists around to jail, why not them too? Or how about the history of Mao and the Cultural Revolution in China? I'm sure they have their fair share of revisionist historians and supporters. Or how about those Christian apologists who are trying to distance themselves and the church from such historical problems as the Inquisition, the persecution of scientists, and all the other injustices over the centuries? Obviously, the list goes on. And one can't really point to one particular era of history and say it is, it has special status over all the others. It just doesn't work that way. And essentially, the Austrian court, with all its good intentions to protect the Jewish people, has committed the same crime against free speech as those Muslims who are now railing against the recent inflammatory cartoons depicting Mohammed. From the perspective of maintaining our civil liberties and our right to free speech, the Holocaust is no more beyond reinterpretation than Islam is removed from insult. Homeland Security Department recently ran a mock internet attack to test its preparedness in cyberspace. They called this test Cyberstorm, and it was the largest cyber war games exercise ever conducted. It was designed to gauge just how well the U.S. and the international community could respond to devastating attacks over the internet from not just terrorists and enemy states, but also from anti-globalization activists, underground hackers, and bloggers. That's right, bloggers. The Cyberstorm simulation was meant to be a challenge to government officials and industry executives to, quote, respond to deliberate misinformation campaigns and activist calls by bloggers, unquote. The Cyberstorm gathered officials from the United States, Canada, Australia, and Britain, and they also brought on executives from Microsoft, Cisco, and VeriSign, who simulated attacks using isolated computers, and they worked in the basement offices at the Secret Service's headquarters in downtown Washington. Now, according to the accounts, the internet survived the attacks, whatever that means, but the Homeland Security Department will not be disclosing its final report until later this summer. Now, in this day and age, it's generally felt that with the meteoric rise of the internet And with the information and communications revolution still very much in full swing and still very much progressing and under development, the threat of networked groups and individuals to spread disinformation and to engage in wide-scale social engineering campaigns has never been greater. One could imagine, for example, a fleet of blogs that are calling for people to rise up over an issue like runaway global warming. Consequently, that the Homeland Security Department considers bloggers a potential threat really shouldn't come as a complete surprise. The military would likely shut down threatening and subversive blogs during times of war or civil unrest. Of course, it would have to be extremely serious civil unrest, obviously during wartime, all bets are off. When I say wartime, I'm talking something a bit more serious than, let's say, campaigns like in Iraq or Afghanistan that are currently, I think by historical standards, minor skirmishes in the large scheme of things. It's during such episodes, and now I'm talking about more severe episodes of war, civil unrest, that control of information flow becomes tactically paramount, so much so that nations often regress to de facto authoritarianism and even totalitarianism. And one just needs to take a look historically at propaganda campaigns during World War I and World War II to get a sense of just how authoritarian or totalitarian the United States and other countries got during wartime. They basically ran a forced economy, a war-based economy, and built a culture around it, an ethic around it, and a mindset around it to drive the war effort. And I also think, for example, of Orwell's 1984, where you really had an entire nation organized and mobilized around the threat of the other. And whether that threat was real or imagined, it didn't matter. The fact was is that the state could organize their people around this particular threat. Back to the cyberstorm. As a result of the state being able to, take on this kind of authoritarian and totalitarian mode when it comes to managing information, the state does have the power to claim a monopoly on the memesphere, or the meme sphere, including extreme censorship and propaganda campaigns. And I have to think that freedom of speech is really a peacetime luxury. At the same time, however, I have to think that the real impact bloggers could conceivably have is overstated. I don't think memes work in such a pervasive way, particularly not today in the age of diversified media. If blogs could actually cause people to riot, for example, it's not because the blogs are telling them to do so, but because there's a genuine reason for doing so. But as the Cyberstorm exercise shows, the revolution will not be televised, nor will it be posted on a blog.
Left, right. Left, right, 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 left.
All my soldiers march.
Left, right, left, right, left, right, left.
All my people march.
Left, right, left, right, left.
Soldiers march.
Left, right, left, right, left, right, left, right.
All my soldiers march with me.
Switching gears just a little bit, going to move off topic from the issue of freedom of speech, but going to continue to talk about warfare and the development of, future technologies. The military, particularly the U.S. military, doesn't appear that they're going to be missing out too much on the biotech revolution. They are considering some radical ideas as it's currently preparing for combat preparedness for the period 2020 to 2050. And I'm serious, there are documents on the internet that will show you that the U.S. military is in fact conducting foresight activities for the period of 2020 to 2050. boggles the mind to think what kind of a world they think that they'll be engaging in, and particularly in military combat. When I think of Kurzweil and other futurists and what their predictions are for those particular decades, I have to wonder just what the military thinks is going to be going down in terms of technological capability. But in particular, during this period, the military is hoping to expand on its idea of non-lethal force and integrate it with the cognitive and behavioral sciences. And again, just thinking about the rate of technological change, I'd have to think that the kinds of systems and techniques that the military are developing today are really more basically the kinds of things you can expect to see in the next 20 years, like even within the next couple of years to about the year 2020, when it thinks that these things will actually start to get underway. But in particular, a couple of scientists, chief scientists William L. Baker, Eugene J. Bednarz, and Robert L. Sierakowski of the Air Force Research Laboratories Directed Energy Directorate and Munitions Directorate, they're working on a concept that's regarded or known as controlled personal effects. Kind of a spooky name, controlled personal effects, but that's pretty much what it is. With CPE capability, the military will be able to target individuals with non-lethal force and to make selected adversaries think or act according to the military's needs. It's thought that CPE will give rise to the potential to physically influence or incapacitate personnel. So it's not just, I guess, a non-invasive kind of way of attacking the enemy in that it's non-lethal force, but it's actually even manipulating how the enemy will think and behave, and the kinds of senses that the kinds of sensory input that their brains will accept, which will impact on their decision making. This is some pretty radical stuff. As an example of this technology, there is what's called active denial, and this is again another non-lethal, what's called a counterpersonal millimeter wave system, and it creates the sensation of burning skin. And that's right, it creates the sensation of burning skin. And it's meant to repel an individual or a group of people without actually physically harming them. Also, by studying and modeling the human brain and the nervous system, the military hopes to acquire the ability to mentally influence or confuse personnel. Through sensory deception, for example, it may be possible to create synthetic images, like holograms, to confuse an individual's visual sense or to confuse his sense of sound, taste, touch, or smell. Essentially, advanced technologies will enable the future soldier to remotely create physical sensations for the enemy, such as pressure or temperature changes, basically making the life of the enemy extremely uncomfortable. More invasively, though, through cognitive engineering, scientists will eventually develop a better understanding of how an individual's cognitive processes affect his decision-making processes, namely such things as pattern recognition, visual conditioning, and difference detection. Once understood, military scientists could use these cognitive models to predict a person's behavior under a variety of conditions, with the potential to affect the enemy and his goals, using a wide range of these so-called personal effects. That about wraps it up for today, I think, but not before I just wanted to mention that a friend of mine and a very excellent cosmologist working out of the former Yugoslavia, Milan Sirkovic. He's updated his website, and I recommend that you take a look at it because he has a number of excellent articles on there that he's written or has collaborated on. Sirkovic, he is interested in things like astrobiology and SETI, the evolution of galaxies, baryonic dark matter, the philosophy of science, quantum mechanics, future studies. He considers himself to be a transhumanist. And he's also interested in existential risks and the history of the physical scientists. He is, as far as I'm concerned, a world-class authority on the Fermi paradox and issues pertaining to SETI. And I recommend, for example, his article on the importance of SETI for transhumanism. And you can find that link either through his website, which I'll give a little later, or through JET, which is the Journal of Evolution and Technology. And recently, along with Robert J. Bradbury, Sirkovic recently conceived of the migration hypothesis, which is a new, potentially new solution to the Fermi paradox. And he's trying to kind of force SETI into the 21st century by giving them a post-biological sense, a digital perspective to future intelligence. And interestingly, Sirkovic is collaborating on a book with WTA El Presidente Nick Bostrom, and they're doing a book on global catastrophic risks that they're hoping to publish by the end of this year. So check out Milan's site for a number of other excellent articles, and just do a search for Sirkovic on Google. It's Sirkovic, and you can take a look at some of his interesting insights into cosmology and, of course, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and transhumanism. Thank you once again for joining me today on Sentient Developments Radio. I hope you enjoyed today's program. As always, comments are welcome. You can catch my email address on my blog. Go to Sentient Developments at Blogspot, and hope to catch you guys in the very near future. Everyone have a good day. Bye-bye.